the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Less than a third of Americans meet physical fitness standards, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We talk with a Wisconsin wellness educator about how new physical fitness guidelines and find out what people of all ages can do to start or improve our fitness routine. What does your workout look like? How long do you work out each week? How have you made working out a habit? How has it affected your health? Or, if you don't exercise, why not? Do you want to start? What's stopping you if you do want to start? Do you have questions about getting moving? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carrie Zimmerman is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Carrie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
The key takeaway of the guidelines seems to be this: get up and move. Of the changes, was there anything that struck you in particular, Carrie?
Yes, so they started to include children under 6 years old, so really getting started with those younger kids. And also getting up and moving, not necessarily moving in 10-minute bouts now, but just every time you have the opportunity, parking further away, taking the stairs, just little things like that definitely add up.
Children under 6 years old, gosh, I guess children must be a lot different than they were when mine were that age, because it was like they were constantly in motion. Do we notice a trend toward being more sedentary for our youngest?
Great question. So with all of the new technology, kids are on tablets, they're on phones, they're watching screens a lot more often than in the past. So really focusing on getting those kids out, helping them just play, that really helps aid in their growth and development, teaches them great movement skills, and helps them form healthy habits that can last for a lifetime.
Okay, so what do these guidelines tell us about how much adults need to move?
So the recommendation for adults is to engage in 150 to 300 minutes a week of moderate intensity activity, or 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous activity a week.
And that isn't anything new, because that's something we've been telling people to do for a long time, isn't it?
Right, that's similar to what it's been in the past.
Okay, so what do we mean by moderately intense activity?
Great question. So moderate intensity activity is where you're on a walk with somebody. You can carry on a conversation. You might not be able to sing if we're going by the talk test, but you're able to really carry on that conversation. Whereas vigorous activity, your heart's beating a little bit faster, you're only able to say a couple of words without stopping to take a breath.
Okay, and how, so when we talk about moderate activity, this could be running, this could be jogging, but it's more comfortable than the more intense stuff where we really are having to focus on our breathing and it is difficult to speak. What are some examples of a moderately intense activity that would be would be within the reach of most of us who maybe people don't like gyms or can't afford one or whatever, but can you give some examples of some things that we could do that would be moderately intense?
Absolutely. So, and I like how you mentioned people who might not like gyms. It's okay if you don't like to go to the gym. Finding something you enjoy is really the important part, because if you enjoy it, you're more likely to stick with it. And it varies for everybody, but walking is a great one. So you can walk your dog, play with your kids, go to the park with those kiddos. Gardening is a great one. And then more vigorous exercise, running, doing those more intense activities, shoveling when that comes around pretty soon here, things that are really getting that heart pounding.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Zimmerman is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, and we are talking about a new federal report saying less than a third of Americans meet fitness standards physically. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, we're trying to find out why and what we can do about it. If you work out, what's your workout look like? How long do you work out each week? And have you made it a habit? How has it affected your health? Do you struggle with getting into a routine? If you don't exercise, is that a problem? You want to start, but something's stopping you. If you have questions, Carrie is here to answer them for you at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. The guidelines also mention or recommend resistance training, muscle strengthening activity. And what's the point of that?
Yeah, so doing strength training activities really helps keep our muscles and bones strong. This is especially important as we age. You know, it helps us reduce risk of falls, keeps those bones healthy. So that would be going to the gym and lifting weights. Also can be things like yoga, doing that gardening, doing that shoveling, anything where you're really working those muscles.
And my understanding also is that if one of your goals is to lose weight, resistance training is actually better, can be better for that than running or jogging. Is that true?
Yeah, so cardiovascular activity like running or jogging is great to get that heart in shape, but to really tone up and lose those inches, look better, feel better, you really want to include that muscle strengthening activities just to really tone up your muscles and get that look you might be looking for if you're looking to lose weight.
All right, let's take a call from George in Monroe. George, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I'm showing my age here, but I got started on exercising by reading Kenneth Cooper's work that he did with the Air Force back in the 1960s. And this wasn't just some theory. It was based on a tremendous amount of research with people in the military. And his prescription was 3 or 4 times a week to do exercise that got your heart rate elevated. And it didn't have to be, I think it was even like 20 minutes a day, a workout. And, you know, since then, I have heard people like this to say, oh, you know, you can do anything. You can garden. You can walk. I just wonder, what is the research for that? Elevating your heart rate is the key to aerobic exercise, and you do not elevate your heart rate by gardening.
All right, George, hang on. Let's get Carrie's response to that.
Sure. So when we talk about the different types of activity, the vigorous activity, the moderate activity, and even maybe a little less for the lower moderate, all activity can be different for everyone depending on what shape you're in. So if you're in really great shape, gardening might not be a great exercise for you, but it's still a good way to get active. Heavy gardening, so if you're hauling rocks and using a wheelbarrow, that might get your heart pumping. So there's different types of gardening, different types of people who are in different types of shape. In those guidelines you were speaking of, so getting active for 20 minutes a day, 4 days a week, you're really getting your heart pumping, and that would be more vigorous activity. So that's hitting that 75 minutes a week of that vigorous activity. In doing that, you want to do something where you're really getting that heart pumping.
George, thanks. Thanks for that call. Our conversation with Carrie Zimmerman, a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, continues. The new federal guidelines aren't just for adults. So parents, grandparents, and guardians, how do you encourage children in your life to get up and move? Teachers, is exercise part of how you teach? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A new federal report says most of us are more than just a little bit out of shape, and we really ought to get our bottoms up off the couch and get moving. Well, it didn't quite say it that way, but anyway, we need to move more. What does your workout look like? How long do you work out? How have you made it a habit, and how's that affected your health? If you don't exercise, why not? What's stopping you? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carrie Zimmerman is our guest. She's a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. How does physical activity affect our wellness in general, Carrie?
So being physically active is going to help us not get those chronic diseases or lessen our risk. So keeping that heart healthy, keeping those muscles and bones healthy.
And with that knowledge in mind, let's look at the numbers. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, only 1 in 3 Americans meet the new guidelines. Why do you think so few people get enough exercise? What's getting in the way?
I think it's just hard for people. You know, we're working long hours, other commitments, and we have other things that we do for fun. So making sure we're really fitting in those small bouts throughout the day, getting up and walking just for a little bit, or stretching, parking further away when you are going to the grocery store or work, taking the stairs when you have the opportunity, things like that really can add up.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that one of the problems with younger children is all the screen time they get, but adults are probably just as guilty of that, maybe even more so, constantly on social media or just watching YouTube videos or something like that. We've just become a little more sedentary than we used to be, don't you think?
Absolutely. So in the past, a lot of people got their activity through their jobs. But now a lot of us are sitting in front of a computer almost all day, and then we go home and our relaxation time is sitting in front of the TV. So that leaves very little time for exercise. So we have to really focus and make sure we get that in.
Speaking of getting that in, we have a couple of calls we want to for sure get in here. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee first. Marcus, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I do construction. But I've found little ways to incorporate extra little bouts of exercise or whatever. When I'm sitting and relaxing at the end of my day, I'll just stretch and do some basic leg stretches, arm stretches. So I'm still watching the TV, and I've found that I'm more relaxed after stretching. One of the things I do when I'm out doing, like yard work for my own personal self, if I have to prune one of the maples in my yard, I'll grab a bow saw instead of a chainsaw, which I normally use when I'm working, because obviously people are paying for my time, so therefore I can't take my sweet time doing the work. But when I have time to do stuff in the yard, I'll use a bow saw. I purchased a push mower, like where it just has the blades that go around, which was quite strenuous at first, but it's gotten better. And I now understand why my great uncles and my grandfather had forearms that looked like Popeyes.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Let's go next to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, go ahead.
Hi, I'm just taking a break from some of my bouts of exercise. I do about 10 bouts or three to 5 minute bursts 10 times per day of upper body, besides 15 to 20 minutes of exercise on my bike, because that way I can do some vigorous exercise and take some time to breathe.
Breathing is good for us. Yes, we know that. Dennis, thanks for that. That leads into Marcus and Dennis, both examples of people who are getting up and moving. Carrie, another change to the newest round of federal guidelines. You used to need to do at least 10-minute bouts of aerobic activity for it to count toward the 150-minute goal, but that's no longer the case. What do the new guidelines say?
Sure. So the new guidelines say that we don't need to do those 10-minute bouts. Anything counts. So really just focusing up and getting up and moving throughout the day, and really lessening the time that we're sitting and increasing the time that we're up and moving, even if it's not for 10 minutes. It can be 2 minutes, and that's great.
All right. Let's talk to Dennis in Bloomer next. Dennis, good morning. You're on the morning show.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah. I just wanted to call in and let you know what my program is. I'm 75, so what I do is first thing when I get up in the morning, I do about 30 minutes on a stationary bike, and then about twice a week I do weightlifting exercise, like they're 15-pound weights, and I'll do about 90 repetitions with them. And basically what it is, it formed a habit for me. I mean, now when I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is it's a habit of just getting on that bicycle and doing my 30 minutes. And then during the week, I try to do some other outside work. Like now that it's winter time, I'll go out and maybe split wood for half an hour or so every other day. So that's kind of what my routine is. And I still work full time. So.
Wow, 75, working full time, getting all that working out in. Good for you, Dennis. Carrie, we know that types of activity can vary by age. What advice would you give for older Americans?
So older Americans should still get that activity in as they're able. Same for those with chronic conditions or disabilities. It's based on how you're feeling, really. So if you can't do that more vigorous activity, that's okay, still focusing on getting up and moving throughout the day and doing as much as you're able to.
Dennis and Marcus and the people who've called in this morning are doing a great job of getting up and moving. Carrie Zimmerman is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Carrie, is it ever too late to start exercising? Will you see benefits if you start working out for the first time later in life, for example?
Yeah, it's never too late to get started. Some benefits you see right away, just like feeling better, sleeping better, things like that. Other benefits take a little bit more time to really improve that health, but it's never too late to get started.
Callers have talked about being in a routine and doing things every day. Regular exercise is a good habit to have. What's the best way to get started? I think that may be the biggest barrier for some people is just getting that routine rolling.
That is a big barrier for people. Getting started is the hardest part, but once you get into that habit, it's going to get easier. So making sure you remember that. Also, just finding something you enjoy. If you're not enjoying your exercise routine, you're not likely to stick with it. So if you like walking, that's great. If you don't, find something else you like to do. Do a dance type of thing. Do things that feel more productive, like splitting wood, things like that.
And how can regular exercise impact our mental health?
Yeah, regular exercise is great for our mental health. A lot of people use it just as kind of a stress relief. So you're going to feel those endorphins and just feel better after you get that exercise in.
What about the long-term health consequences of not getting enough exercise over a lifetime?
Sure. So not exercising over your lifetime is going to lead to more weight gain. It's going to lead to other chronic conditions, having those higher cholesterol numbers and things like that.
For example, teachers or caregivers incorporate exercise into a child's day outside of the home? What tips do you have there?
Absolutely. So teachers and caregivers should just encourage children to get active and just play and be kids. Teachers can help by just getting those kids up and moving throughout the day, you know, doing little stretch breaks. Kids can only focus for so long. So really just getting them up throughout the day while they're teaching, incorporating activities into their lessons, things like that.
What resources can you suggest for people who want to get started or add to their current routine? Are there some websites we should be visiting, organizations we should connect with? What resources are available for us?
Yeah, so there's a lot of great resources out there. Even if you just Google things, how to get started with physical activity, there will be a ton of things coming up. Gunderson offers a Minutes in Motion physical activity challenge each spring, where we focus on encouraging people to get 30 minutes of activity every day. And that starts in the spring. Our website is gundersonhealth.org/MIM, and we offer a lot of great tips and resources with that as well.
Guidelines have changed over the years. Can we expect that to continue as more exercise research is conducted?
Absolutely. I'm sure that in the future we continue to do more research. We continue to find out what really helps us stay healthy and get healthy. So there will definitely be changes over time as we do that research.
And we haven't touched on this yet, but certainly a healthy diet is a part of making your exercise routine more effective. What's the relationship here between what we eat and how effective our exercise program can be?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's that old saying that you can't out-exercise a bad diet. So putting that exercise in, but also putting the work in the kitchen, getting those fresh fruits and veggies in, getting those whole grains and lean proteins are really important as well.
Okay, well, so that means the beer and burger diet is probably not going to help me too much.
Everything in moderation.
Okay. I was just kidding about that. I don't drink much beer. Carrie Zimmerman is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Network, I'm John Munson. 60% or more of Wisconsin voters approved a ballot measure in 23 counties, cities, and villages encouraging lawmakers to close the so-called dark store loophole. We talked to the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities to get their reaction to the results and consider what might be ahead for this in the state. Was there a dark store referendum on your election ballot? What did the results look like in your community? How was it talked about in your community before the vote? Or was it? If you didn't get a chance to vote on a referendum question on dark stores, what do you want lawmakers to do? Or are you happy with things as they are and don't want any changes? Let us know at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Urban Alliance. Jerry, welcome to the morning show.
Well, good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
First, for those who may not have seen this on their ballot, what is a dark store?
It refers to a tax strategy that actually it's a little bit of a misnomer. The store itself isn't dark. It's not vacant, but the store owner is claiming that for property tax purposes, the value of that store is nothing more than what a dark, vacant, boarded up store would be worth.
And the loophole there would be that the property is taxed as if it were a dark store, that it wasn't occupied, and that's the rub. Am I getting that right?
That's exactly it. I mean, imagine, apply it to your own home. Imagine if you could argue that your nice little three-bedroom bungalow is worth no more than an abandoned foreclosed property in the middle of a bad part of town. And that is almost exactly what we're arguing here.
We know the majority of Wisconsin voters who had a dark store referendum question on the ballot said they want lawmakers to close the loophole. So what do you hope these results will say to lawmakers?
We hope that they'll say, get it done. This bill was introduced in the last legislative session. There was, frankly, a majority of the legislature were co-sponsors of the bills. We just could not get them scheduled for an actual vote. They had public hearings. They went through all of the process. So what we're hoping these referenda, with their, according to our numbers, 4-1 support for this, will say to both Governor-elect Evers and the Wisconsin legislature is, look, people see through this. It's a common sense, fairness question. Let's just get it taken care of. Let's get it closed.
Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Urban Alliance. We're talking about the dark store loophole and the results of various advisory referenda in a number of municipalities around the state of Wisconsin. Voters who had a chance to vote on this urging the legislature to close the loophole. Jerry, you talked about the fact that there was bipartisan support for legislation. There were hearings held. It looked like a majority was in favor of it. So why wasn't a vote scheduled? Where was the roadblock here?
The leadership of the legislature felt that, for whatever reasons, that this bill should not come up for a vote. I should say these bills. There are two bills. Even though we had over 84 co-sponsors of one of the bills and 61 co-sponsors of the other bill. You know, when you look at from the property owner's perspective, this is a pretty good deal. So there were a lot of business property owners that were pushing leadership not to put these things up for a vote.
800-642-1234. If you had a dark star loophole on your referendum ballot, did you support it? And if you didn't get a chance to vote on this, if there was no referendum in your area, would you also urge the legislature to support this? Or do you think that closing this so-called loophole would be unfair to businesses? Either way, let us know what you think. 800-642-1234. Is there anything that local governments can do? Does this require legislation? Can local governments do some things that would also impact this?
Well, unfortunately, the answer there, John, is no. This really, tax law is written by the state legislature. In one of the two bills is actually trying to correct a court case. It's called the Walgreens versus City of Madison case, and that affects big box retailers that are leased rather than owned. Sorry about that. It's early in the morning.
I hear you.
And in the other case, the practical problem for local government, sure, they could take this to court, but in most cases, for an individual city or village to challenge this, it will end up costing more than they collect in taxes. So it's a losing game for these to be fought one at a time, you know, here and there throughout Wisconsin. And the way tax law is designed in Wisconsin, it's designed to be written by the state legislature. So that's really where it has to happen.
Let's take a call. Kyle is with us in Fenimore. Kyle, good morning, Kyle. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Well, I don't have a question, I guess, just a comment. I wanted to say that I'm in favor of closing the dark store loophole, but I had to read and reread that question on the ballot several times to figure out which way I wanted to vote.
Kyle,
worded poorly, I guess.
Okay, Kyle, thanks for that, because I did. That is something that that has come up as the story has been reported, because these referenda were not all uniform. There were some places where people were struggling to figure out exactly what they were voting on. Jerry, what was the problem here?
The problem is it's tax law, and I can sympathize with Kyle. The cities and villages and counties, and there were 23 of them that put this on the ballot, there were a number of different attempts at the language. And the fundamental challenge is, how do you make it simple enough to explain in a ballot question without going the other way and oversimplifying it? There are some critics of the language who said that the question was oversimplified. So I do apologize to Kyle. It was a heck of a challenge. This issue is easier to explain in conversation than it is to actually read on a piece of paper. You can very quickly get lost in the weeds when it comes to property tax law.
Yeah, and that's why we have a lot of lawyers, I guess. Let's take another call. Michael joins us in Green Bay. Michael, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. So I just have a quick comment here. I get that it's not quite a tax break, but any business that can't survive paying its full share of taxes and dues to society really isn't viable. And, you know, it's the capitalistic system that we've chosen to live in. So it's just my opinion for today.
All right, Michael, thanks for that. Michael says, hey, if you can't afford to pay your taxes, you shouldn't be in business in the first place.
Are you waiting for me to agree with Michael or disagree with Michael?
You can. That's up to you.
Well, and Michael raises an important point. Big retailers, people may not realize or appreciate that when it comes to city services, police, fire, ambulance, they're frequent users. They're frequent callers. Some of these biggest retailers in communities will have multiple calls in a given day. You know, contrast that with your own house, where, God willing, you won't have a police call for your entire life. It just, they're part of the community. In most cases, they're a welcome part of the community, but they do need to carry their fair share of the load.
Well, not everyone in the state agrees with you. Some say that local government shouldn't be assessing a property's value based on business income. What do you say to that?
They're absolutely right, and we're not.
Okay, how are you not then?
Well, see, and that was one of the, that's one of the red herrings, if you will, that the opposition puts up about this. You're taxing the value of the building. Whether and the value of the building is driven by its location. Is it in a popular location? Is it well trafficked? There are a lot going on in that particular neighborhood. Or is it, and frankly, there's a reason why some of these stores go dark. It's because the proprietor realizes that's no longer the best place for them to be. And location, 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 right? That's how real estate value is determined. Whether what's going on inside the building is really not much more than an indication that that's in a popular location or it's not. No, we're not taxing the business, we're taxing the building.
So what are you watching for as you move forward here? Are you hoping that you'll be able to get another bill in the legislature after the new year, or what's going on here?
Well, there's a new player in the equation. So the next step in the process is to talk to Governor-elect Evers. During the campaign, the Governor-elect came out and said, quite in black and white terms, he would introduce legislation to plug these loopholes. So we're going to sit down with him. We'll sit down with his new Department of Revenue leadership, and that'll be our next step. Then, of course, we go back to the legislature and try to make the argument again. This time we've got the evidence of 800,000 Wisconsin voters saying, yes, plug these loopholes. So back at it again.
Let's sneak in a quick call here from John in Appleton as we close this segment. John, go ahead. You're on the air. Be quick.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask the speaker, how would you tax two stores that are built exactly the same right next to each other? One is very successful. One is not successful at all. Would you tax the successful one more? I mean, how do you develop the tax for this loophole implementation?
Okay. We got it. We've got it. Less than a minute left.
Very simple. If you have two identical buildings in essentially the same area, the same block, excuse me, it's early in the morning, you would tax those buildings the same. It's the building. It's not the business.
Okay. John, thanks. Thanks for sharing that. And Jerry DeShane, thank you so much for being with us and giving us a little insight into the issue of the dark store loophole. Appreciate your time this morning.
Glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Urban Alliance. He joined us in our Madison studios. Coming up next, we'll talk about a proposal at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point this week that would cut six humanities majors and change the school into one that mixes liberal arts into career-minded majors. We'll find out what you think about that in a little bit. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A proposal from the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point this week would cut six humanities majors and aims to change the school to one that mixes liberal arts into career-minded majors. Our guest journalist joins us to offer the latest details on the plan and what next steps would look like. Did you graduate from UW Stevens Point with a humanities degree? What do you make of this possible change? What do you think about cutting French, German, geology, geography, and two programs within the art department at UW-Stevens Point? Good idea? Bad idea? Why? Why not? Under this change, the school aims to meld liberal arts into career-minded majors. What do you think of that push? Is this a good idea? And again, why or why not? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, so under this proposal, a number of programs in the humanities majors would be cut. Did I have that right, that it was languages and history and things like that?
That's correct, but one point I should make is that not all of those are humanities. People would make the distinction that, yes, it's liberal arts, but geography and geology are not part of the humanities.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought those were sciences, but...
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so why were these particular degrees selected?
There was a lengthy conversation over the last several months on campus involving faculty, students, staff, led by Provost Greg Summers, and the chancellor obviously was a part of that conversation. Now, the proposal that ultimately was presented yesterday was not shared with the people who've been involved in the committee until after it was finalized, which might be a point of contention for some, saying, well, gee, we feel like, you know, you just asked us what we thought and then you decided what you wanted to do. But the decision was based on numbers. Quite a bit of it is numbers. History majors around the country have been declining, and the history major is a really good example of one that has lost almost half of its enrollment as a major in the last 5 years. So these are low-demand majors that will be replaced by high-demand majors, and an interdisciplinary approach that completely reshapes the university in terms of how its academic structure is set up.
Okay, so something that's part of this push is we're talking about melding the humanities and some of these other programs into career-minded majors. What does that even mean?
Well, there's a lot of conversation about workforce needs. And when students go to college, a lot of times they don't have any idea what they really want to do with their degree. They know that they have an intense interest in a subject area, and so they pick what excites them, which is what people encourage them to do. In the past, you could take history and find a job. You know, there are lots of famous people who majored in history, John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Lee Iacocca. But today,
the host of this radio program.
There you go. And actually, the architect of this proposal, the provost, majored in history and was a history professor at UW Stevens Point. But the world has changed. The critical thinking skills are, and the team building, all of those things that are fundamental to the liberal arts are still extremely important. But there's also concern from parents and students that, hey, I want to make sure that I can actually get a job when I graduate. So their idea, the concept, is to infuse more of a background to broaden your understanding of skills and to broaden your skill set, so when you graduate, you hopefully are on a better track for a career.
Is part of what's driving this the way that the cost to the students has gone up dramatically over the past 20 to 30 years, and at the same time the level of state support has gone in the other direction. So is this ultimately about money?
That's how it started, and I think that certainly is at the heart of it. UW-Stevens Point has a nearly $8 million structural deficit. So it was certainly driven by money, but also there's a conversation across the country now about does a college degree pay off? And universities are under a lot of scrutiny because there's some who say that, you know, college degree isn't as valuable as it used to be because it's so expensive, and there is a concern that you know, that it takes longer sometimes to graduate. So part of this thinking here too is to streamline majors and try to speed up the time it takes for students to get through with better advising. That's a critical part of this, is better advising to really guide students and get them through faster.
Well, I mean, advising has been something that's been sort of a sore point for decades, so that's not new. But what about the idea that one of the reasons that students might need more than 4 years to complete a degree is because they're working three jobs to try to pay their tuition?
Absolutely true, and that's one of the other factors that the university is talking about, and that's the need to have more online courses, the flexibility that, you know, you can take your course whenever you have time to study it online. But absolutely, the cost and the fact that a lot of students are working while going to school does make the time require more time to get through, but also advising is a problem. And it always has been a case where, you know, universities get a reputation for just taking students' money and not really helping them get through. And now there's a lot of pressure that they really do need to guide them more.
So what would these cuts mean for faculty at UW-Stevens Point? Are we losing positions there?
Well, it's not entirely clear how it's going to be done. At this point, they're discussing 6 to 10 positions of faculty. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean tenured faculty. Some of them could be adjuncts. UW-Stevens Point has 317 faculty members, and 98 of them are on a tenure track. And as you know, tenured faculty are never laid off. I shouldn't say never, but rarely laid off, because that's a job protection that is included under academic freedom. Mm-hmm. So they could do layoffs, but nothing about that has been decided. They could, in phasing out majors, have people shifted to other disciplines, you know, other places within the university. There could be retirements. There could be people who leave. And some would argue that, you know, taking away a history major waters down the expertise in a university. But at the same time, they want to focus on strength areas like natural resources.
Sure. What happens to students enrolled in the programs that are being cut?
Well, they would be allowed to continue their program and finish their degree. And admissions to that major, those majors actually also are continue to be open until the Board of Regents takes a final vote on this. So if your student is interested in majoring in history and they're applying for admission this fall, they would, they would be allowed to go into those majors, and they would just phase them out over time as the students currently in them would finish them.
And we're not talking about just eliminating the history department altogether. Students could still take classes in history or geology or one of the languages we mentioned, right?
Absolutely. What they're talking about is reducing the number of upper level courses. So
okay.
The depth of what you learn would be changing. But those disciplines would be incorporated into these so-called career focused majors. And you could still take them absolutely as a gen ed requirement, although fewer students are taking history courses, in part because they take AP U.S. history in high school and get the credit for that in college.
What's the, you mentioned the Board of Regents, I assume that's the next step for this proposal, is that it goes to the Regents for their approval?
Well, ultimately it goes to the Regents, but what's next is the campus community will have 90 days to review the proposal, and they can provide feedback to the Chancellor, and there could be changes to it, but at the end of the 90 days, then the Board of Regents would take, because of majors being cut, they routinely, you know, adjust the academic array at campuses, but because there's a possibility of a layoff, that would require Board of Regents approval and involvement.
Yeah, layoff is, that's two words no university administrator ever wants to use. Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, thank you, Karen, so much for joining us this morning to talk about this. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Appreciate your time this morning. I'm John Munson. It's the Ideas Network.